This is Jean McMillan interviewing Mr. Donald Buckley at his home, 84 Main Street, Salisbury, Connecticut. The date is September 27th, 2011. May I have your full name?
Donald Bright Buckley, 440423, Lieutenant Junior Grade, United States Navy.
Where were you born and the date?
February 4, 1924, in Memphis, Tennessee, by complete accident. My family were on a business trip.
And could you give me a thumbnail sketch of your background?
Well, it's going to take a big thumb. My family were in Washington, D.C. for five generations. My granddad was publisher of the United States Supreme Court. That meant that the justices would send him their handwritten opinions, and he would put them into type for the time that they were delivered on the floor of the court. My great-grandfather got the Congressional Medal at the Second Battle of Bull Run. At the age of six, my total life revolved around music. That's all I wanted to do. And I practiced not because I had to, but because I loved it. By the time I was 12, I had my own band, Don Buckley and his Buccaneers. And we first started playing at high school proms. But we got pretty good, and the next thing we knew, I was playing at the Shoreham and the Willard and for Treasury Department dances. And I kept music as my prime life. And a couple times where other kids in my generation ran away with the circus, I ran away with the big bands. And finally, Granddad made peace with me and said, look, I'll stop having the Pinkerton men bring you home if you'll agree to go to college and get a degree. I said, that's fine, but the thing I want to do is to go to Duke, because the Duke Ambassadors is the number one college jazz band by that Downbeat magazine poll year after year. It's won Johnny Long and Les Brown. And I'll go to Duke and get your degree, and then I want to go to Juilliard and get mine. Fair enough. So I managed to land the featured tenor role with tenor sax role with the Ambassadors. And we were courted by quite a few schools as well as Duke. And MCA heard us and offered us a guaranteed build contract as soon as we all came home, because all of us were in one form of the reserve or another. I was a Naval ROTC cadet, and while I was at Duke, I also wrote two musical comedies, one called Stand By and the other one Too Many Goodbyes, and they were both wartime romance themes. Anyway, we graduated, and we all went to war, and out of 16 of us, only 8 came back. And that ended my love for music as a performer. At any rate, I did serve in the Pacific on a destroyer as a fighter director officer. It was very fortunate. BUPERS, Bureau Personnel, decided that musicians, orchestral musicians, were best qualified for intercept officer, aircraft intercept, because they simultaneously could sense melody, harmony, counterpoint, orchestration, lyric, etc. And the many facets of an air intercept to get an enemy airplane required the ability to address many things at once. So I was lucked out. Instead of my class getting amphibs, I got destroyer duty and a great ship. We were the first ship into Nagoya when Japan fell. And my favorite story is that my commanding officer, Norman Smith, was a great guy, and his wife sent him a scrambled egg hat when he got his promotion from lieutenant commander to full commander. And he opened the package one night in the wardroom and said, gentlemen, I will not wear this hat until we sail into Tokyo Bay. Finally, the magic day came, and I was on the bridge with Frank Zamboni, the gun boss, and out came Norman Smith in his dressed buck blues with all of his ribbons and his beautiful scrambled egg hat. And there we were sailing into the dawn with Fujiyama in the distance, and every hair on your head was standing straight. And a gull came up over the bow of the destroyer on an air current, and it came up over the bridge, and suddenly there stood Commander Smith with dull gull drippings all over the front of his scrambled egg hat. He said, "Mr. Slaymaker, relieve me with a cake de con." He went below and he came back in a little while in his dirty old steaming khakis and his tattered old steaming hat, and he said, "Full speed ahead, steady as you go, and gentlemen, that was the last damn Jap kamikaze."
What a wonderful story.
Oh, he was quite a guy. So I came home, and it turned out that the 6 offers I'd had for jobs had all been withdrawn because America was on strike. And I did have a chance to go to cut the umbilical cord and move to Wilmington, Delaware, as the public relations guy at the Blue Cross plant. And I wrote all of their letters and brochures and things of the sort. But that was just a sampling of what I wanted to do. Then a job opened up with a tiny little advertising agency in Wilmington, and I got the job as, quote, the copy department, and had to bring in business, and it was a stopgap situation, and my resume went out all over the place, and finally, bingo, I got an offer from Vansant Dugdale in Baltimore, which was a very well-known regional advertising agency. And 3 wonderful things happened to me there. First, I learned from one client about true patriotism, from another, from the boss, about being a gentleman in ethics, and from a man I worked with, a new technique that I had no idea I would ever master. First guy was Steve Wilson. He was president of the Fram Corporation. When war broke out, Pearl Harbor Day, he called the White House and said the facilities of the Fram Corporation are available to the United States government for the duration at no profit. And on VJ Day, he called in his accountants and said, "I want a summation of all of our activities during the war." It turned out they'd made about $250,000 profit. He wrote out a check from that amount and drove down to Washington and presented it in person to Harry Truman.
Oh my word.
Wilbur Van Sant was the traditional Maryland gentleman, owner of Van Sant Dugdale, and he was offered a tobacco account. And he said, "Gentlemen, I believe in the power of my business, and I don't believe in your product. Were I to accept your statement, your account, it would make us a lot of money, but I would have to lie to you or to me. I'm sorry, I can't take the business."
A gentleman with ethics.
Exactly. The other thing was, I had the Fram oil filter account. In those days, it was not the standard equipment on a car. You had to add it. And it was quite an aftermarket advertised commodity. The problem was, in those days, there were no self-service gas stations. Kids from high school or college had jobs pumping gas. And they were not learning very fast on how to install oil filters. So I had this crazy idea, let's give them training manuals that look like comic books. Well, there was a very famous cartoonist, Will Eisner, who had a strip called The Spirit, and it was all in Sunday papers. So I made a contract with Will, and we made this series of comic books, just like his Spirit comic strip, called Hoods Up. And in the narrative of pretty blondes coming into the service station and all that sort of stuff, it taught the kids how to put on an oil filter. Well, later in my career, that was going to be more than I had ever dreamed it could be. Anyway, I was in Baltimore and loved it for about 4 years until I discovered that the executive vice president was earning only a couple thousand dollars more than I, and I was barely making it. So again, I started a job search. Well, this time, fortune hit in Cincinnati with Stockton West Burkhart. It was a very good agency. They doubled my salary. But the big thing was I could understudy the copy chief there named Rand West, who was an absolute genius and great teacher in the art of persuasion and copy. So I went out there as assistant copy chief, and I worked on Hudepole beer, Red Cross shoes, Chungking chow mein, all sorts of things, and enjoyed it immensely. Another great story, Gino Pollucci was the president of Chungking chow mein, and he and I got to know each other pretty well, and he loved to gamble. Well, across the river from Cincinnati was the Beverly Hills Country Club. It was a great casino. And Gino was coming into town, and I was going to take him to dinner after a meeting and go across the river. And so the night before he arrived, I dreamed all night long, Black 17, Black 17, Black 17. So Gino arrived, and we had a very successful business meeting. Went across the river to Beverly Hills, went into the casino. I bought $100 worth of chips. In those days, that was a lot of money. And I kept playing Black 17, Black 17, not once. And so I gave up. I was leaving the table, and the croupier came to me, and he said, "Monsieur, I'm so sorry you were here last night." He kept coming every time, Black 17, Black 17. That's when I learned that ESP is good, but timing is better.
So true.
At any rate, it turned out that just as when I was in Wilmington, you work for the company, and if you didn't work for DuPont, you were nobody. In Cincinnati, do you work for the company, and if you didn't work for Procter & Gamble, you just weren't quite acceptable. I loved Cincinnati. I joined the Masons there and was doing very well with the agency, but knew that it was time for me to move on because my dream had always been Madison Avenue. Well, I went to New York on an interview trip, and through a friend that I developed at Van Sant Dugdale, who was now working good in New York, he sent me to several people, and I ended up talking to Charlie Brower, who was the first American with the title of Vice President in Charge of All Creation. And Charlie decided that since I knew music, I knew theater, I knew copy, and he wanted a shock team led by one copy group head that was unassigned to a definite account but only worked with him on troubles. And would I love the job? I said, "You betcha my life." And with a certain doubling of salary again. Well, by the time I had moved out of Cincinnati, sold the house and rented an apartment on 63rd Street, the copy chief on the Shenley account was rushed to the hospital with a bleeding ulcer. So guess who had to take over the Shenley account? And I learned very quickly how he got his bleeding ulcer. Lou Rosensteel was the man who was addressed only as Mr. Chairman. And he was quite a bombastic and pushing man. And he had the unfortunate belief in magic. He had heard that the Nazis had talking dogs, and he sent a vice president to Europe to investigate what had happened. Turns out that they had an amplifying thing in their collar, so when they barked, it sounded a little. The vice president came back and told him and was immediately fired because he hadn't done a good job. So he then sent the account executive from BBDO to Latin America to bring him back 100 parrots. The reason being, there was a law in New York that you could not have a brand advertisement in a liquor store. You could say, "Gin makes nice summer coolers," but you couldn't say whose. However, he had a Bibra blend, that's a second level blend, called Corby's. And the trademark of Corby's was a parrot. And his primary advertising vehicle up to then had been the asbestos curtain in every burlesque theater in the East had an ad for Corby's with a picture of the parrot. But he thought if he could get parrots back, and they could teach him to say Corby's, and he could put one in a liquor store. He could get around the law and push his friend.
That's a clever idea.
It was totally against the law, but one morning we discovered that at the Empire State Building, a whole floor of the Shenley offices had been cleared, and there were 100 cages in there with parrots, and a trainer walking around with puttees and a crop saying, Corby's, caught, Corby's. Well, nothing happened for a week, and Rosenstiel was a very impatient man, and he said, Johnson, they're going to take Corby's body another week or day, and you got to go. One morning, we discovered that the Empire State Building on that floor, all the windows were open, and all the cages were empty, and all the parrots had flown out over New York, and that's why, for years thereafter, you saw sightings of parrots in Central Park. Well, I had to go from there. Warwick and Legler was trying to solicit the Revlon account, and they decided, since I knew how to make comic books, I could make storyboards, and this was in the infancy of television, and it was an art that nobody knew how to do. Well, I did, and I made it with Charles Revson, who was one of the toughest guys in the world to work for, and I have the world's record of survival on the Revlon account for 8 years.
That's remarkable.
But the problem was, when I was on the Shenley account, they had a sales manager named Erwin Swan, and we had a chemical problem. And he kept screaming at us at meetings and swearing at us in Yiddish. And in one meeting, I'd had it, and I answered him in Yiddish. And by the time I walked back to BBDO, I said to Charlie, I think I'm in trouble. He says, yes, you are, so why don't you get some resume out and take your time and do a little work, you know? So the owner of Warwick and Legger then hired Erwin Swan as his leading account executive. And I knew right then and there I couldn't stay at Warwick and Legger. So I went to this important flesh peddler in New York, Jerry Fields, job headhunter, and presented my problem. He said, I know just what to do. You're going to go to Gray as associate creative director on the Revlon account. I said, I can't do that. There's a non-compete clause. They can't hire me because I'm working on another agency. He said, no, you're going to resign and go to Jamaica for a month on, with all expenses paid, and come back and miraculously get a job at Gray. I said, how do I know this is going to work? He says, because you got my guarantee. Well, that's how I went to Gray. At Gray, it was wonderful. I had the full reign of the Revlon account. But I had 3 live television shows a week. So I was working incredible hours and into the night because all of the commercials then were live. And it was the $64,000 question and the $64,000 challenge and the Walter Winchell file and then the big party, which was one of the first variety shows. So when they were going to launch the big party, Charles wanted an ad saying that the first performance had been a huge success. So I took him an ad that showed a bunch of people, the blurred clapping of hands against the night skyline of New York, and it said the show that umpteen thousands had applauded. And he said, that's great. I want to see photographs on Friday, on Monday. I said, Charles, I can't get a guy to do this over the week. I said, I want to see photographs on Monday. Well, I've been a hobbyist photographer for a long time, and I had a dark room in my apartment in a certain place. And so I got a bunch of friends in, got them a few drinks, and I had some black seamless paper and punched holes in it and put lights behind it so it looked like skyline. And gave them a couple drinks, got them down on their knees, and had them clap their hands over their head and shot it at a tenth of a second to get a little blur. And printed out, took it to him Monday morning, and said, fine, print it. Well, how to bill him? How could I bill him without it being conflict of interest in the agency? So I went down to City Hall and found a disbarred lawyer who was helping people get licenses, and suddenly I was John Bright, photographer, and I ran it as a sideline from there, and made quite a little bit of money on the side.
Good for you.
But finally I'd had it with Revlon. I just had to get off of it. And Gray wanted me to stay. So they took me off, and made me associate creative director of the whole agency. And I did Procter & Gamble, I did General Foods, I had a lot of big accounts, including Milkwave Lilt for Procter & Gamble. And the commercials were done on the Miss Universe pageant, which meant I had to go to Florida every July.
Perfect timing.
Oh, boy. And I remember one time the commercial was starring, I can't remember her name, and Julius Caruso, hairdresser, Ida Lupino. Well, she was 5 inches taller than Julius, so we had to build a runway that he could walk down so they looked the same height. And he also couldn't say permanent. It was permanent. It was a disaster, but we managed to get through the shows. At one point then, one of the top headhunters in New York began talking to me about wanting me to go to Foot, Cone, and Belding as executive vice president, creative director. And no way, I'm happy at Gray. Well, the meetings went on, and the stock went up, and the cash went up, and finally it got to the point where you couldn't say no. And I hated to leave Bernie because we were the closest of friends, and we were like brothers. But I talked it over with him. He says, Buck, you got to do it. And so I did, and found that my predecessor had not been told he was fired, and that I was coming in to replace him. And it was very difficult because he was also a friend of mine.
Oh, my.
But that was a lesson on Madison Avenue.
Now, what brought you up here?
I'll get to that shortly.
Okay.
Any rate, we might work that out. And I said to them, I cannot rebuild the agency without firing the dead wood. But if you do it, you've got to take care of them with good pensions. So I got rid of 30 people. And I hired 50. And suddenly we're winning awards, we're winning Clio's, we did Contact, the Time Pills, we did the Frito Bandito, and I was really loving it, but the pressure was unbelievable. So I bought a stone farmhouse in Woodstock, New York as a weekend retreat, and I was spending every weekend there a long time. I would work out a deal where I'd commute in on Monday morning and out on Friday at noon. But we had Saverin Coffee. I did the Ellis Agente campaign. And Footcone was a strange outfit. It had three different offices. New York was Emerson Foote, Chicago was Fairfax Cone, and Los Angeles was Don Belding. And there was a strange interrelationship, but the idea was that the New York agency could have an account that was competitive to one that would be in Chicago or L.A. And we had Saverin Coffee in New York, and L.A. had Hills Coffee. So Fairfax Cone, who was a legendary, difficult man, came in and to have a conference on how I had restructured Foot, Cone, and Belding to bring it up to being one of the hot agencies in town. And we went over the plan and everything, and then he said, well, tell me about Saverin. And I said, I don't think I should. Because what are we going to tell our clients if I'm talking to you about Saverin and you're talking about Hills? That's a conflict of interest, and I would rather not, sir. And he said, thank you, and he got up, and I knew at that moment I was dead. Well, we were threatened with the loss of TWA account because it was a hip pocket thing, and they were not getting good advertising. And I went to the president of the New York office, great guy, and said, I want $350,000 that I alone can expend. We're going to put together the damnedest airline campaign that's ever been done. and we're going to save this account. And he agreed. And I bought the rights to Up, Up, and Away and did the campaign. We produced every commercial and every print ad in advance. I rented the Rizzoli Theater and turned it to the lobby portion, or the lounge portion, into looking like an aircraft interior. Their whole board of directors came. They said, gentlemen, you entertain us on your flights now. We're going to entertain you on one of ours. And the presentation went for 4 hours, including being served lunch with the stewardesses in the new uniforms.
Perfect.
And so Tillinghast, the president, came up and he said, I have two questions. Yes, sir. Do you have a pen and a contract? $17 million.
Wow.
And that was a lot of money then.
Oh, yes. It still is.
Well, a year later, TA was having real internal problems because of the competitiveness of various different departments. And they hired an efficiency expert. And he said, well, the first thing you got to do is to get rid of the agency. And we were fired. And Faxcone chose that as an opportunity to fire me and 100 of my people on the street by 5 o'clock, losing all benefits, all stock, all pensions.
Oh, my.
So I went to my Woodstock retreat, and I finished the parts of the textbook that I wrote for McGraw-Hill on advertising management. And then Bet Bernie, the old pal from Gray, had left Gray and started his own consulting firm. He said, come on, let's make it Con Buckley Associates. So we did. And we were the first boutique working only with top management on the creation of new products and the doctoring of sick advertising campaigns. So Bernie and I was a good art director, two good secretaries. We were doing all kinds of things on heavy retainers and having a ball and working for, you know, big time clients, General Foods, Procter & Gamble, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Bernie was way out on margin in the stock mess just about 1970, a little before that. And then to get out of it, he wanted to expand. And I said, Bernie, what you're doing is recreating the advertising business. That's what we tried to get out of. Oh, but Buck, I've got to. I need the money. Look, Bernie, if you want to do it, I'm not going to stand in your way, but I ain't going with you. So I went to my farm in Woodstock, having just been divorced after a 20-year marriage to an alcoholic narcissist, and started the Bucks Foundation for the Survival of Man, which was an environmental research organization with a small organic farm as a learning experience in stewardship of the planet. And I was writing stories for Mother Earth News, and doing all kinds of wonderful experiments in organic farming, and became terribly alarmed at our inability to store nuclear waste, and set out there to make a dent in it. Well, the American Federation of Advertising Agencies asked me to come out to Hawaii and speak to their convention with the subject, the environment or the economy or both. And I was pointing out things that American business could do. I was green Kermit. Well, it got me in all kinds of trouble. Then the Woodstock Festival happened, and it totally changed the town. It had been a town of writers, musicians, artists, legitimate. The festival actually happened 60 miles away, but ever since then, you'd find these junked up guys running around town looking for where it happened. And it just changed the town. I said, that's it. So I was also on Nixon's list, the FBI list, the CIA list, as a malcontent about nuclear energy. I said, well, I'll shut up now, but I took a compass and I drew a 50-mile circle around every single place that there was an existing or proposed plant. And I said, I want to move beyond where that is. The only place in southern New England is the northwest corner of Connecticut, because I stopped the nuclear reactor at Cementon on the Hudson River by getting the Bard students all upset. And that's what brought me here. And I've